This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Yesterday, the White House offered its most detailed explanation yet as to how discredited allegations about Iraqi attempts to import uranium made it into the president's State of the Union message. Deputy National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley told reporters that he failed to remember two CIA memos that specifically warned against the credibility of that report, which has since been exposed as a forgery. Most of our program will focus on how and why this happened and whether, as the president has said, the matter is now closed. But first, there are important developments today in both Iraq and in Iran. In Tehran, Iran's intelligence minister said today that a large number of al-Qaeda suspects are in custody there, including some high-ranking members of the group. In a few minutes, Peter Bergen will join us to talk about that. We'll also bring you reaction to the death of Saddam Hussein's sons in Iraq, but we begin with news today from Baghdad. The U.S. commander in Iraq, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, announced the capture of number 11 on the list of most wanted men. He's been identified as Barzan Abdal Ghafur Suleiman Majid al-Takriti, formerly the commander of the Special Republican Guard. Joining us here in Studio 3A to tell us what today's capture means and who this man is Amatzia Baram, professor of Middle Eastern history at the University of Haifa in Israel and a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace here in Washington. And it's good to have you back on the program.
It's a pleasure, Neil.
First of all, who is this captured leader? You showed me an extraordinary genealogy of the Iraqi regime and of Saddam's family.
Yes, I managed to go back 11 generations from Saddam back. In my own family, only four, but it's easier with Saddam. In any case, Barzan Abdal Ghafur Suleiman Abdal Majid Tikriti, his great-grandfather is Saddam Hussein's grandfather on the father's side.
And
okay?
On
the male side.
And that makes him a second cousin?
That makes him second cousin twice removed. And in the Iraqi power structure, it is not sufficient that you are a major general or a lieutenant general commanding, say, the Special Republican Guard. To know all the secrets, the really important secrets, you need also to be a cousin, either on the mother's side or on the father's side. This guy is a cousin on the father's side, and I can tell you he knows everything. He can explain to the American authorities, A, how come Baghdad collapsed so quickly? What happened with 20,000 Special Republican Guard, or in Baghdad, 12 to 15,000, who were supposed to guard the city, to fight behind the population, to get lots of Iraqis killed before they die or surrender?
Make it the Battle of Stalingrad.
Exactly. What happened with the Stalingrad of Iraq, of Saddam Hussein? Was it premeditated? Or was it just a collapse? What are the orders given to these soldiers to do after the war, or once they feel that they need to sneak out of the battlefield? Were they ordered to retain their weapons and ammunition and to attack American soldiers after the collapse of the Iraqi opposition, or is it just a matter of personal choices made by various officers and non-commissioned officers, and we'd like to do it, whatever? He also knows a lot. I would say almost that there is to know about weapons of mass destruction. He's sharing this knowledge underneath Saddam, of course, and his chief bodyguards, whom America has now in custody. He shares this knowledge with another guy, which I don't think you have. His name is Hani Abdel Latif Tilfah At-Tikriti, who is Saddam's second cousin on his mother's side. And he was the commander of the SSO, Special Security Organization. So this guy was a commander of the Special Republican Guard. They were working hand in glove with the Special Security Organization when it comes to weapons of mass destruction. So these two guys, between these two guys, should know everything, including, of course, the guys you have already in custody.
Would he also know whether Saddam Hussein fled in panic and has been running from house to house, or whether he had a concrete plan to leave Baghdad and then...
Absolutely. It seems like, to me, especially after the news of yesterday, that Saddam Hussein simply had no plan B. He had no plan B. This is amazing because Saddam always had plan B, C, D, F, G, and whatever, H. So it's very, very strange, but he will know. Yes, he'll know. There is this, I want you to know, in Iraq there is this myth running wild, according to which Saddam managed to prepare for himself a real underground shelter, I mean, a cellar somewhere, very deep, and he's there. But now that you got, I didn't think it was real, because for him to build such a thing, he needed to kill afterwards about 2,000 people. That's a bit difficult. But on the whole, no, if his two sons are dead, and probably his third son as well, we don't know about him, because there are two other people killed in the skirmish. Yes. We don't know who they are. Then it seems he had no plan B. But he will know much more than anybody else. No, he and the chief bodyguards whom you have anyway.
Tell us a little bit about what the special Republican Guards did. There was, of course, the Iraqi regular army. Yeah. Then the Republican Guards, an elite unit that did so well in the war against Iran and less well in Desert Storm and in the most recent conflict. The special Republican Guards, what was their role?
Well, the Republican Guard didn't do all that well in 1991 and now as well, because they simply are not your match. That's all. It's a third world army. Even if the best unit there is not your match. But the Special Republican Guard, they are about a force of about 20 to 23,000 people. Most of them were stationed in Baghdad. No one else was allowed carrying weapons, to enter Baghdad. Only these guys. So they're mostly from Saddam's own tribe and very close and friendly tribes. And these guys have been trained very well, and I mean even Western style, very well in light weapons, small weapons, you know, handguns, assault rifles, RPG, you know,
rocket-propelled grenade,
mortars, not even howitzer guns, mortars. These guys are today the most dangerous for you because they took off their uniform, donned off dishdasha. Dishdasha is this Arab gown, you know, and vanished into their own families and villages and towns. And now go find them. These guys are the ones who are causing a lot of trouble to your forces in Iraq now.
Just before we let you go, in that blizzard of names, Barzan, Abdal, Ghafur, Suleiman, Majid, Al-Tikriti, which are the ones that identify this man as a relative, as a cousin of Saddam Hussein?
It's very simple. Barzan is his first name, okay? Abdul Ghafur is his father, okay? Suleiman is his grandfather. And Abdul Majid or Majid is his great-grandfather. That's the connection.
I see.
That's where he meets with Saddam Hussein, because Abdul Majid is Saddam's grandfather. Saddam is Saddam's first name. Hussein is his father's name. And Abdul Majid is his grandfather's name. So that's where they both meet. Majid.
And Al-Tikriti simply means from Tikrit.
They are from Tikrit, yes. Okay. It just means a place, yes.
Well, thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
As always. That is Professor Amatzia Baram, a professor of Middle Eastern history at the University of Haifa in Israel, now a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace in Washington, D.C. Peter Bergen, the author of Holy War Incorporated, Inside the Secret World of Osama Bin Laden, is also here with us in Studio 3. And there was news today from Tehran, an announcement from the country's intelligence minister, Ali Younesi, that Tehran is holding many members of al-Qaeda. Peter, good to have you with us as always. Do we know who is being held? And he said many members.
Well, the interesting thing is you've got the intelligence ministry saying this, the Iranian intelligence ministry. The people that we know that U.S. officials have told me that are being held there, one of them is called Saif al-Adl. He's an Egyptian, number three in al-Qaeda, probably the military commander now. He's been held for some time. Suleiman Abu Rait, who is the spokesman of the group, a Kuwaiti. He appeared seemingly out of nowhere post 9/11. And two others, one called Muhammad al-Masri, which just means Muhammad the Egyptian, who is supposedly a trainer, and another guy who's an aide to Ayman al-Zawahiri, the number two. Now, these are the people we know. There have been suggestions that Saad bin Laden, who's bin Laden's 23-year-old son, may be in custody in Iran. Also that Ayman al-Zawahiri, bin Laden's number two. It seems to me that both those reports are essentially erroneous. Now, what the Iranians are doing with these people is a very interesting question. I've heard from Afghan officials that al-Qaeda members in custody in Iran have been handed back to them in the past. Some governments don't want these people, by the way. Like, apparently the Kuwaitis don't want Suleiman Abu Rayt back. Who they've revoked his citizenship. They don't want him back. He would cause a problem. You know, are the other people I've mentioned so far are all Egyptians? Have the Egyptians and the Iranians talked about repatriating these people to Egypt? I'm not sure. You know, would the Iranians contemplate, you know, using them as a bargaining chip with the United States? Perhaps. After all, Saif al-Adel would be somebody who would be incredibly interesting to American authorities to speak to. This is a guy, he's a former Egyptian police officer. He is somebody who is intimately involved in the planning for the U.S. Embassy bombing attacks. He would know a great deal of things that American authorities would be interested in hearing from him.
So the other big question is why now? This comes 2 days after President Bush accused both Iran and Syria of continuing to harbor terrorists.
Well, I mean, I think you just supplied the answer. I mean, yeah, we're harboring them, but we're harboring them in custody. We're not giving them succor. We've imprisoned them, and I think these people, by the way, Neil, have been in prison for some time. I don't think that they, you know, magically have been in prison in the last week or so. I think they've been in custody for some months now.
So they were not in Iran operating cells, and then the Iranians said, "Hey, we've got to shut this down."
I'm not clear, but I mean, I think that they have been in custody for some period of time. Clearly, you know, if you're in Afghanistan, Iran is a pretty good place to go to when you're disappearing after 9/11. And we know that people have been traveling back and forth. As I mentioned earlier, the Iranian government has turned members of al-Qaeda back to the Afghanistan government. So this is, you know, it makes sense that some of these people would be in Iran. Now, were they planning terrorist attacks against the United States? I don't know the answer to that. The fact is that they've been in custody for some time. And let's look on the bright side here for a second. Between all the arrests in Pakistan this year and these arrests, the Iranian ministry, by the way, hasn't confirmed these names, but I'm telling you what U.S. officials are saying, at least privately. You know, that means that the upper echelon of this group is largely, except with the exception of bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, are in custody one way or another, which is, you know, basically a net good thing.
Yet we continue to hear reports of Western Pakistan and Eastern Afghanistan, Southeastern Pakistan and Afghanistan in particular, of a resurgence of both the Taliban and al-Qaeda.
Well, Neil, I was just in Afghanistan relatively recently and went out on one of those operations. I think the resurgence, I think it's more Taliban than al-Qaeda, and I'll tell you why. If you're an Arab member of al-Qaeda, you stick out like a sore thumb in Afghanistan. I mean, there's no way that you could, it's very hard to hide. Even in Pakistan, you stick out. I mean, one of the interesting things to me is how in Iraq, Iraq has become a real magnet for al-Qaeda, which is, you know, enormously ironic given the fact that one of the putative reasons we went to war was a supposed link between Iraq and al-Qaeda. Well, that seems to be happening now, as of in the last, which makes a lot of sense because you blend in with the population, you've got a lot of fixed American targets. It would make sense that Iraq is, you know, a new important theater of operations for this group.
So, you know, given that there are people in Iraq now, do you think?
I would... Yes is the answer to that. And I mean, I hear that from a lot of different American officials. And that's a recent phenomenon. They're basically coming over the northern border from Syria. Some of them are Saudis. But, you know, it's common sense. I mean, if you're interested in killing Americans in a place that's right in the middle of the Middle East, Iraq is that place.
Peter Bergen, as always, thanks very much for coming in. Peter Bergen is the author of Holy War Incorporated, Inside the Secret World of Osama Bin Laden. He was with us here in Studio 3A. When we return from a short break, how Iraqi Americans are reacting to the news of Uday and Qusay Hussein's deaths yesterday in Iraq. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.